Good morning, all.
Good morning.
The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed. Before I continue, I'll let you know I'm not reading Psalm 22 up front, okay? So I'm just going to read a smattering of other parts of Psalms. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know your name put their trust in you. For you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. But on the other hand, why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? And then again, you have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O you who have been my help, cast me not off, forsake me not, O God of my salvation, for my father and my mother have forsaken me. But later, but the Lord will take me in. Again, a note of hope. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. But then again, in despair, do not forsake me, O Lord. O my God, be not far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord of my salvation. Hope, for the Lord loves justice. He will not forsake his saints. They are preserved forever, but the children of the wicked shall be cut off. And yet again, despair. Do not cast me off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength is spent, for my enemies speak concerning me. Those who watch for my life consult together, and they say, God has forsaken him. Pursue and seize him, for there is none to deliver him. O God, be not far from me. O my God, make haste to help me. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to another generation, your power to all those to come. The Lord is near to all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. He fulfills the desire of those who fear him. He also hears their cry and saves them. What an incredible chasm that the psalm presents to us. This incredible distinction between God's nearness and his farness of misery and hope. This is but a small sampling of what the psalms give us in the face of the anguish and difficulty assumed by life in a fallen kingdom, which will be the focus of VBS. The psalms are poetry pregnant with pain, written by people who wrestle with reality. The Psalms speak to us deeply, maybe foremostly because they speak so profoundly about sorrow. While the Psalms speak of joy, praise, and thanksgiving in abundance, they do so in the shadow of a much larger body of work, and that is the category of lament. Laments occupy the largest category of the Psalms by far. And there are both corporate, for the whole body, and very personal individual laments, as this psalm is. And the causes of these outcries are as varied as we experience them in our own lives. Sometimes it's sin, sometimes sickness or betrayal, even the sense of meaningless suffering. And as a testimony to our personal God, the overwhelming majority of these laments are personal, individual laments, which express personal, direct conversation with God. Together, I think the Psalms serve as our best counselors of grief. They aren't simplistic or dismissive about hard things. And so while the world heaps up empty cliches to help itself cope, And therapies and medicines abound, some notably better than others. There is no resource on the planet that approaches the honesty, the clarity, and the depth of the Psalms, especially with regard to grief. It may seem odd, though, to focus so narrowly on painful things in one's life. It may even seem unhelpful. You know, don't look at your circumstances. We might even think it's dishonoring to God to be down about life. And undoubtedly, when we are hurting, there will rise up those who will want to be dismissive, who will tell us to just think happy thoughts and be grateful for what you have. Just let go and let God. But if you or someone you love is in a season of difficulty, I just personally encourage you not to run roughshod over your grief. That's not how healing happens. Instead, consider reading and praying the Psalms, especially the laments. They're easy enough to find. In them, you will find solace that leads eventually to joy. And I have experienced this personally. On the day Hannah and I found out that we had lost a baby in seminary, it was a pain. It was a pain-filled psalm that the Lord led me to begin the healing process. But importantly, that healing began with pain and tears and deep grieving. Again, the laments are not difficult to find in the Psalms. Their titles help us, as with Psalm 22, God, why have you forsaken me? And within most of these Psalms, there are unique and recognizable features. And we can kind of do two things by knowing these features. One, it helps us to better understand and sort of dissect the Psalm. But two, it can actually help us formulate healthy prayers of grief and lament. So there are different ways, of course, to dissect a lament psalm and break it up. But one simple framework I've found has fourfold elements. So one, there's a clear problem stated. Two, there's a clear expression of trust in God. Three, there's perplexity or confusion expressed. And four, there is deep sorrow that is expressed. And that sorrow often turns in the direction of enemies that one is complaining against. Now, that's a fairly simple framework to work with, but I want you to notice a few things. For one, there is no requirement of a happy ending. And if you've read the Psalms, you know that's true. There is trust that is exercised, yes, but because the laments are so often written mid-course in someone's grief, the trust isn't offered in connection with a particular outcome, but rather a general abiding trust in God himself. Indeed, part of what makes grief so hard is just not knowing what's coming next. A second thing that I'd want to point out is this idea of perplexity being expressed. It's not something I was as clued into prior to this study. In it, we find a sort of admission of ignorance about what God's doing. Lament Psalms often express a certain confusion about the pain that the writer is going through at the hand of God. And because the pain itself is in some measure attributed directly to God, we can see why that's confusing and causes angst. God, are you doing this? Are you behind this pain? Are you involved with this? I thought you were the good God, the merciful God. Often these are formed, or they show up in the Psalms in the way of questions, and generally unanswered questions. So Psalm 6:5, "For in death there is no remembrance of you, and Sheol, who will give you praise?" Psalm 13:1, "How long, O Lord?" That's a genuine question. "Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" The psalmist doesn't know. And so it's perplexing, confusing. And it is here, in apparent bewilderment, that Psalm 22 begins. David yells out, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning?" And there's no answer given. That word for groaning there in verse 1, it may be more accurately rendered roaring, often accompanied with the roaring of a lion. And even if the word groaning is to be supplied, we should expect that it's a rather loud groaning, especially given what follows. Verse 2, "Oh my God," for the third time, claiming God as his own. "I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest." This is no quiet, buried cry. Although the cry that we do bury deep, the cries that we refuse to express outwardly in the end seem to serve as the longest and loudest heart cries. But here, the cry is loud. We learn from Psalm 32:3, "When I kept silent," this is in regard to sin, "but when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long." I suspect the same is true of grief. This is really important for those of you who have been trained to bury your grief. Grief, when it is hoarded and buried within rather than admitted and shared without, it creates a lot of noise internally. Here the psalmist himself is not remotely staying quiet. But there is a silence here. It's like a deafening silence. Where's God? God, where are you? I can't see you. I can't hear you. Are you here? At the end of verse 2, your Bible probably says something to the effect of, "I find," or "I have no rest." But the literal language is more poetic and, I think, more potent. It's literally, "There is no silence to me." I thought we were saying God was silent. He's saying, "There is no silence to me, no silence for me," as in there is no calm and quiet before me, because God has not answered. Even though we might stay quiet about our grief, we have to admit that it is a noisy ordeal. And we all long for quiet to be offered to us. And the psalmist is saying, "There is no silence, no quiet towards me, because God is being silent, because he hasn't said a word." I don't know if there is anything more disquieting than God not speaking. And that's what the psalmist is expressing here. When we grieve, when we go through hardship, we are busy with thoughts. We are heavy with doubt. We are loud with emotion. We're kind of like cars that drive by with their windows up, music blaring. Other people can kind of hear a faint sound, but it's not until you step inside the car that you really hear how loud it is. And that's how it is with our suffering. People see it a bit, but until they enter in, they have no idea how loud it is. And so we yearn for the Lord to quiet us with a word, with a comforting word. But here for the psalmist, it's far away. And it's not just the word, but the one speaking it. Verse 1, why are you so far from saving me? And that farness reemerges later in desperate cries. Verse 11 and verse 19 echo the same. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. But you, O Lord, do not be far off. O you, my help, come quickly to my aid. For David, it is this experience of God's farness that defines what he has called God's forsakenness to him. For God to forsake David, in his mind, was for God to turn his face away and remain far off. And so the questions are equivalent. God, why have you forsaken me? God, why are you so far away? And so the questions in verse 1 express this perplexity, this despair. Why God? Why so far? I think this is too important for us to breeze past, because oftentimes Christians have been, I think, actually trained to regard lightly or to dismiss altogether things that are sad, things that are hard, things that are unjust, because Jesus has won the final victory. And so we run roughshod over the hardship of life, or are dismissive with others' pain. And this is not my opinion alone. So I recently sat with a group of pastors, and one of the things that came up in our study was this topic of grief. And the pastors were really disturbed at the trends that they saw. And that was shown most clearly in trends with funerals. Funerals were being trimmed down, trimmed down, trimmed down, shortened, shortened, shortened. But not only that, they're being transformed from a time of true grieving to this time of sort of superficial celebration. It's not that we don't celebrate life, but there is something wrong with that. And these pastors recognized it, acknowledging some of these funerals look more like birthday parties than anything else. But that stands in stark contrast to the New Testament. Consider some of the commands of Jesus in the New Testament. Grieve, mourn, be wretched, fast. All commands given us by Jesus. But consider the training. I'm in right up, right down, right happy all the time. I'm in right up, right down, right happy all the time when Jesus Christ came in and cleansed my heart from sin. I'm in right up, right down, right happy all the time. That is not an honest picture of the Christian life. It's okay to sing songs of joy and celebration, but not at the expense of acknowledging true grief and despair. And it's not just kids' songs. While the Psalms are absolutely chock full of lament, and despite the enormous amount of Christian music being produced, you'd be hard-pressed to find much of a sour note in the whole lot of it. Where is it? Is there no sorrow in the Christian experience? Because we have Jesus? It's a problem because it's just not real. And it trains us to trivialize hardship. Jesus said, "In this life you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world." But the world overcomingness of Jesus' victory should not prompt us to live in denial about the troubles we all face. It's supposed to be a guard against being overcome by despair. But we are overtaken by another enemy, superficiality, when we pretend like the troubles we experience don't matter much or don't matter much to God. And so it is not only okay, but it is actually fitting that we at times ask, "How long, O Lord? Where are you, God?" These are questions of the Christian. Even the question we feel is so distasteful and so disrespectful. Why, God? Why? But let me make a hard stop here. Because there is more going on than participation in pain and shared grief in this psalm, though that is present. There is a risk with this particular psalm of focusing so much on our shared experience of pain, or even David with his suffering, that we lose sight of the gravest suffering that the psalm is intended to point us toward. Psalm 22 is not filled with generic boilerplate language. It's very specific. And while we cannot always locate the historical setting of a psalm or what it's specifically about, Psalm 22 is not one of those. In fact, there's no missing what the psalm is about if we read it carefully, and if we read it in light of the New Testament. This psalm is about a certain someone experiencing a certain something. And we might be surprised at first to learn that that person is not really David. And so what he writes about himself as hyperbole, because he hasn't experienced what he's written to that extent. So what he expresses as hyperbole and sort of exaggeration has become for us prophecy in Jesus Christ. One writer explains it this way: David descends with his complaint into a depth that lies beyond the depth of his own affliction and rises with his hopes to a height that lies far beyond the height of the reward of his affliction. In the words of another, these sufferings transcend those of any historical sufferer, with the single exception of Jesus Christ. They find their exact counterpart in the sufferings on the cross. They're more vivid in their realization of that dreadful scene than the story of the Gospels themselves. The most striking features of these sufferings are seen there in the piercing of the hands and feet, the body stretched, the intense thirst and division of his garments. So to illustrate this, I'm not going to preach on this part. I'm just going to read you parts of this psalm and their direct connection in the Gospels picked up. And I trust that that will be remarkable enough, hearing these verses of the psalm completely fulfilled in Jesus Christ as recorded in the Gospels and beyond. Verse 1 of Psalm 22. my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Mark 15:34. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which translated, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Back to the Psalm, verses 6 to 7. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. Matthew 27:39-42. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross, and we will believe in him. Back to the Psalm, verse 8. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Matthew 27:43. Listen to the precision of the language. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Back to the Psalm, verses 14 to 15. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust. John 19:28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished, in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I am thirsty. Verse 16 in the Psalm. For dogs encompass me. A company of evildoers encircle me. They have pierced my hands and feet. John 20:25. The other disciples therefore were saying to him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I shall see his hands and the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Following in verse 27, then he said to Thomas, reach here your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side, and be not unbelieving, but believing. Continuing in the Psalm, verse 17 to 18, I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. All of the Gospels, all four, pick up on this. But Matthew includes the idea from verse 17 that they stare and gloat over him. Matthew 27:35-36. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. Back to the Psalm, verse 22. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. And picking up from Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11 to 12. For both he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one Father, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will proclaim thy name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing thy praise. Back to verse 24. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, and he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. Hebrews 5:7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. He was heard. But although Jesus' cry was heard, it was our cry, it was our need, it was our prayer that was answered. The next verse in Hebrews. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. Let me be clear. The psalm teaches us a lot about affliction and how to deal with us. But this psalm is not about us, or even about David. This psalm is so clearly about Jesus Christ and what he has suffered to get us. How far he has come and how far removed he was from his Father to be near to us. In the words of a pastor friend of mine, simply put, Jesus went through Psalm 22 so that you could have Psalm 23. Now, that doesn't mean that you and I don't participate in some measure in the pain and turmoil expressed in Psalm 22. And it's not wrong for you to take solace in it and to ask when you've lost all sense of God's presence in your life, God, where are you? But because the psalm does not just express any human pain, but expresses the most severe human pain suffered by God himself in Jesus, we must claim the part of the psalm which is ours in full. And that's the end of it. The end of the psalm is for us. From verses 22 on, God satisfying us in verse 26 and verse 29. In verse 26, why don't I just read from 22 down, and we can see ourselves in here. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you offspring of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him. All you offspring of Israel. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. That afflicted there is using a singular, referring to Jesus. And he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. From you comes my praise in the great congregation. My vows I will perform before those who fear him. And now the afflicted in verse 26 is plural. It's us. Alternate translation there is the poor. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. May your hearts live forever. But amazingly, it's not the poor only, but even the prosperous. The salvation is offered so generously. Verse 29, all the prosperous of the earth eat and worship. All of us have this offer extended to us. It's by Jesus, fulfilling, satisfying, walking through this whole psalm experience that we get to participate in communion today. And that is not just communion with elements, that is communion with one another, and foremostly communion with God. Because of what Jesus has done, we get to share in the celebratory meal. We get to eat and drink and be forever satisfied. And this is just a picture of what we will celebrate eternally with Jesus in heaven. I think maybe it's appropriate to close with a poem, given that when we reflect on the Psalms, we reflect on poetry. So this is a simple poem, but it expresses the wonder of what God has done and the meeting of these two diverse things, hope and despair. So here's the poem. Hope and despair, peak to trough, nearby or far off, God is my God. Where can I go from your spirit? Would I go if I could? Whom have I in heaven but you? And what compares on earth below? All the heavens of my heart are but a hell if you be not there. But where are you not? If you are everywhere at once, you are at once here. When I see you not, and hear only my cry echo back, still you reside. I would rather you chide than be silent still. Here in my lows, here in my fears, here in my failures and tears, you forsake me not, and your word declares you cannot. I am here, and so you are. My God, forsaken and forsook, but not forsaking those for whom it took. You have held my hand when I felt it not, and when you brought me at last to the place I should rot, where unquenched wrath was stored, it was you hoisted, you burdened, you disheveled, Father grieving, Spirit leading, Son outpoured. Glory bathed in shame, joy imparted through pain, hope in despair, peaked the trough, near brought far, so very far. God, my God, why you have forsaken me not? We'll leave it there, and I will ask the worship team to come and lead us, preparing our hearts for communion.